How's it going, buddy?
It's going pretty good. I am in the middle of allergy season here in Maryland, so that's been kind of rough. But other than that, things have been pretty good.
I feel that, man. Did I tell you that I did full allergy testing down here, and I'm essentially allergic to Florida. Like half the trees, yeah. The grass, the weeds, the mold. So I'm doing allergy shots, and it's not to the point yet where I could tell if it's working, but I'm hoping at some point it'll start helping.
Yeah, I feel that. When I was down there, it was pretty rough as well. And I'd be lying if I said it did not factor into moving out, seeing on like the weather app every day, the pollen level basically being at like apocalypse tier.
Yep.
For basically year round.
Yeah, it's definitely noticeable for me too. And it's on my mind. And I did also find out that a lot of the things that I'm allergic to are not present in the Pacific Northwest. So keep that in mind. Yeah, man, I'm excited. I went back and watched a little bit of our last talk and realized you didn't get out of Full Sail in our conversation. Like we bounced around a lot and there was a lot of really good stuff. We've got so much more to cover still.
Yeah. I mean, Full Sail is an important part, right? Because there's a lot to talk about there in terms of like career development and making sure you're ready for the next step.
Yeah, but I think that's probably a good place for us to start is, were you ready? Like at what point did you start looking for your first gig and kind of what was that last few months like?
I realized pretty quickly coming up on the end that I was not ready for like a AAA job in particular. For other stuff, I felt like I was probably good enough given like our like final project went, like the kind of stuff we were doing during the final project. I feel like I could contribute in some capacity to a project, but in terms of like being ready for what I like, you know, really wanted in the industry, like not even close. Like I definitely needed more time to figure that out. And kind of the first little while of like job hunting, I feel like I kind of confirmed that for me, right? Where for a while you just don't really hear anything, or you hear something back, and then you get into like the screening interview and you realize, oh crap, I don't know as much as I thought I did, you know. And so at that point it was basically kind of like a not back to the drawing board, but I knew that I needed to like, you know, while I knew it was gonna take a while at that point, so I needed to like figure something out in the meantime, but still wanted to work on games or something like that, you know, adjacent. And so initially I just kind of started doing stuff at Full Sail. I started doing like tutoring and would do the lab assistant thing for a while, helping out with some classes that way. But then also just on the side of that, tutoring for individual instructors, like classes, like I helped out with some like the programming classes, because that was one of the things I was already, you know, pretty decent at, at least compared to what was expected of students at that point. So I could help out quite a bit there. And then kind of for money, I mean, because those things didn't really like pay. So for money, I just kind of like I had two roommates and I did a little bit like indie stuff on the side, just like contract stuff. Some of it was, you know, just to get something on a resume, because it was not gonna like actually pay me much, sometimes not pay me at all. Like there was some that were like those whole deals where they bring people in, they're like, oh yeah, we'll like give you like equity eventually when the company you know exists.
Yeah.
So obviously, you know, nothing was going to come from that, but like it was a project that had some semblance of officialness, right? That I could point to.
Yeah.
Be like, hey, I did stuff.
It's on a good portfolio builder, too, right? Like you're actually getting some experience. And then also the teaching part is that's the best way to improve your own skills, too. you get much more confident in the things that you have and that you're able to kind of reinforce and build that knowledge of. And yeah, that's you just have to be careful not to get caught in that loop where you want to stay there, right? And that you don't branch out and continue on to try and grow, you know. And it sounds like, you know, obviously eventually you got to that point, you know.
Yeah, but the project that I worked on, or the person that I worked on or with, I guess, that I actually was able to make money with, was a one of the instructors who had their own like indie studio kind of going, and I kind of, you know, had the skills to help out with them and the rapport that they could, you know, trust me to like do work and work hard on whatever they had. And that's kind of how I made ends meet. I kind of relied on that person and on my roommates to live very, you know, cheaply, and was able to kind of do that until I was able to get a more like a better paying, you know, like salary job.
How long was that time frame?
I think it was like probably about, let's see, graduated probably like middle of the summer, I think, and then, or somewhere around then, but maybe beginning of summer. And then I started at Cubic, which was my first like well-paying, like full-time sort of game job.
Mm-hmm.
I started that in, I want to say, either late fall or like early winter of that same year. So probably like four to 6 months.
That's not bad. I mean, that's, we usually tell people you should plan for about a year, right? Like it can easily take a year to get that kind of work. So we had a question in the chat. How did you keep yourself motivated with your solo projects and that kind of stuff?
So that's actually one of the things that I kind of wish I did more of at the time, and also the time leading up to graduating from Full Sail was more solo projects, more like modding, more stuff that would be like outside of you know, just my portfolio, my you know, student project.
Mm-hmm.
For portfolio pieces, when I was right out of school and to the point where I got hired, I actually didn't have any solo projects. All those projects I just talked about, I was working with other people on them. One of them was like a, you know, some company that just contracted people sprint to sprint all over the world, basically, to work on some like passion project for some guy. And then the other was, you know, a indie project ran by someone in Orlando, and it was just me and them for the most part.
At least you had somebody to help, right? Like if it was if it was on your own, that's definitely a much more difficult thing when you're balancing trying to live and look for work and all those other things. It's, and also try to enjoy yourself a little bit, right? Like it's a lot.
Yeah.
So how did this you said Cubic, is that the name of the studio?
Cubic, yeah, it's a part of one of those massive, like, kind of like government contractor companies that just does, like, you just think of something some company would do, some service, and Cubic is like one of those companies that just like does all of those things. And one of the things they do is MilSim, as someone pointed out in the chat. So the place that I worked at for them in Orlando is called Cubic Global Defense, and what they did and what they still do, as far as I know, is basically like training simulations for the Navy. And the project I was working on was for littoral combat ships, the LCS program, and the objective of the project was to provide like a photorealistic set of training programs and like missions, basically, that would teach sailors how to do roving watch duty and how to turn on the ship and how to like turn off the ship and certain like troubleshooting things. But the main gist of it, the stuff that I particularly worked on, was knowing your way around the ship, where everything kind of is, how to, where the documentation is on the ship, because there's like these little books in like every room that kind of like tell you how to like turn things on and off and basic stuff like that, everything that the watch person would need to know. And then how to go through just the checklist of here's how you turn the thing on, here's how you turn it off, just get it ready, kind of that kind of stuff. Because if you do it wrong, you can hurt yourself or hurt the ship. And that was the goal of that program, was reduce the amount of people that hurt themselves and reduce the damage done to the real ship. Because how they did it previously was, to train someone on that stuff, you had to bring the ship in, bring them out to the ship, walk them through it, and then ships would get like damaged and all kinds of stuff. And so it was kind of along those lines. And they did, other stuff there as well, like on other projects, like damage control and like other things, like walking people through like how to deal with that kind of stuff.
Interesting. I assume that was all first person, right? Because you're trying to make some kind of a,
It was
simulation,
first
right?
person. Yeah, it was first person. It was in Unreal. It was fairly impressive, like the amount, like the technical kind of stuff that went into it, the level of detail as well, like the realism. We did like kind of like one-to-one mappings of the ship and everything in it. So it was pretty detailed, pretty large project. We had very beefy machines that we needed to run that thing.
Bet.
But yeah, it
How
was a
big
good
were the
learning experience
teams?
there. I think when we were kind of in full on production mode for the program that I was on, we had like, I'll say like 12 strike teams, and each strike team had like 8 people on it, like a couple technical designers, an engineer or two, a web dev person, and then us, me, and a couple instructional designers. And they get each strike team will get assigned a set of lessons or like an area or a system on the ship, and then go through and do all like the lessons for it. And that included like making sure the space is all, set up, all the interactables are there, they're all linked together in the simulation, creating a lesson plan out of the documentation, running through that, fixing all the discrepancies. And if there's anything like weird, like we'd have to like talk to the ship and get like what the real deal is with a certain thing and fix that up. Because these were like tailor-made to the ship that they were going to go to. So, you'd have like LCS2 and LCS4 or whatever, and they'd have different plans potentially, because when they're building them, they're each ship's kind of its own little unique snowflake when it comes to the quirks and things on it, and we had to account for all that. So, 12 teams, about probably like 8 people each, plus an engineering staff and art staff and some like producers, stuff like that.
And was this a case where you were handed a finished model first? Like, 'cause it's a simulation, right? So it should be like built to spec. Where normally we would build something out, we'd rough something out, and get the play part of it done before it becomes beautiful. Was it the opposite way for this?
So when I got there, they already kind of had like a mock of like a rough kind of outline model of the ship that they built in all the spaces inside. Like each compartment was kind of like roughed out. But then we had to go through the process of going into each space and then replacing all the rough block out stuff with the realistic models and all the interactables and all that kind of stuff. So the levels were kind of prototyped out, so to speak, and the spaces were traversable. But we had to fill in all the details and create all like the lessons and all that kind of stuff from scratch.
All right. That's cool. The lessons. That's such an interesting way to think about it. Like it is a giant tutorial, right?
Yep, it was. It was just a, however many compartment and system tutorial. There was, dozens and dozens of lessons, thousands of lines of dialogue that were kind of like, you know, robo voice voiceover thing. That was a fun process to deal with. And then you know, thousands of interactable objects. It was lots of really impressive work, and at a pretty high scale. So it was a really good kind of preparation kind of experience, because it was a very organized kind of big scope project that had you know, you kind of just fit in to a place on the project, and you kind of just did your thing. So it was kind of like being in a production environment on a game, even though it was, you know, just like a training for the government.
And that's one of the things I try to really, you know, drive home here, is there's so many similarities between like SimViz type work or like military sim work and game development, because it's the same tools, the same processes, the same ways of thinking. It's just who's your customer and you know, what's the content that you're trying to make.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great place to kind of start, cut your teeth. And one of the things that you also kind of get when you start that route, or are just in that space, if depending on like what you value in the industry, is you get a lot of freedom outside of work to do your own thing, right? There was there were several, you know, indie studios at, you know, Cubic, basically made up of just people that work there that just on the side outside of work were kind of doing their own thing. And they kind of had the freedom to do that, right? Because, you know, MilSim for the most part, just like a 9-to-5 deal. You go in, you're just a part of the production, and then you leave. And then, you know, as long as you're not spilling any details or anything like that, they don't, you know, care if you're working on your own side thing.
That's cool. Yeah, that would be interesting. Like, having that opportunity to be around people who have the same kind of skill set, the same desire to do something fun, and the same, you know, work or availability to do it, that could turn into something pretty cool pretty quick.
Yeah, there's, I don't know if they're still active, they might be, but one of the indie groups there, what was the name? I want to say Suckerbird Games is a local indie outfit in Orlando that was made up of basically just people at Cubic. And they, while I was there, I think went through the whole phase of like designing, prototyping, and releasing a game on the side, great, outside of work.
That's really cool. I love that. Man, it's so hard to find the motivation to do that stuff after work, though. Like, even if you want to, you know, and you have the availability, at least for me, I've got to also have the energy and, you know, that spark, and that spark's not always there.
Yeah, it's tough. You know, that was one of the reasons why I didn't do that was, you know, just the amount of work that went in during the day to kind of get out what we needed to get out in time. Just did not have the energy to do more game development once I got home. But, you know, a lot of that effort that I did have when I got home was towards, hey, I still want to work on entertainment games. So figuring out how to do that.
Yeah. And so how did you do that? Like, that's the other thing is, you know, when you've got a full-time job, luckily it's building the same skill set, but then finding the time to improve your portfolio and do things to help improve your chances to move into full-time game development had to be a bit of a, you know, it had to be difficult at times, at least.
Yeah, it was, for me, it was a lot of just refining the portfolio, refining the resume, and making connections. So I would do things like, you know, just look at the postings at a, you know, company that I'm interested in that I like that have a, you know, has a posting for a job that I think I can do, that I have the skills for, and then I would, you know, try and tailor my resume for that. Instead of just having something generic and sending it out there, I made sure that, you know, I wasn't speaking the language of the position that I was after. But, like, you know, doing so within the realm of like what I also understood, you know, not like just like lying about things, right?
Because that's
it's very easy to tell when someone's doing that, like very quickly. But like, you know, making sure that my resume is tailored to what I was looking for, making sure that I was talking with colleagues and friends and instructors that like were in the industries and you know, knew their stuff and I could reach out to and get advice from them about it, and have them kind of like when they were available looking over, like I, you know, see a position at, you know, XYZ company, set my resume up for it, and then I, you know, message somebody and say, hey, here's the position I'm looking at, here's my resume for that position, what do you think, got any notes for it, like, you know, if anything I can improve, that kind of thing. And after enough times of that, my kind of hit rate of getting callbacks from recruited stuff started just going up and up and up. And I like to think at this point I've got like a pretty good, you know, dial on that, right? Even though now, you know, once you're after a certain point, you don't really send, you know, you don't really like apply for things anymore. But towards the end there, like when I was still looking, it was you know, you get it down to a science, and you and the way you do that is you keep trying and you make sure you talk with people that are, you know, in the know, that are in the industry, either hire people, help hire people, you know, or have gone through that process themselves, and there are tips and tricks to follow that'll greatly increase your success.
Yeah, absolutely. That's some dedication too. I think that's the kind of thing that, that a lot of people start to do and then they lose the motivation to do it when it doesn't start working quickly. Right. Mm-hmm. And, but man, that's great. 'Cause every bit of information you got from anyone just helped improve, even if it was just a little bit at a time, but then over time it became something that, that got the job done. That's fantastic.
Yeah. Yep. And it's, you know, things like, especially when you talk to people that have hired people, or have helped hire people, you very quickly realize that, for example, one of the, I imagine people in chat might be wondering, like, what are these, what are some of these tips and tricks? Well, one of them, for example, is when the HR person provides a list of candidates to a hiring manager or a group that is going to be working on hiring a person for a position, they are given a very large list, typically, of resumes. And these people are also very busy. They're working on a game. That's very busy work. Not a lot of time. And so each resume in that first big batch is probably not going to get, like, a lot of time. So you got to, like, hit all the high points very quickly in your resume and think about what's at the top, what's in the middle, what's at the bottom, what is the most relevant things. So, you know, one of the most relevant things is going to be just summary, you know, very succinct summary of exactly why you are the best for that position in very short, easy to read bursts. Second most important thing would be work experience. What have you worked on before? Where have you worked before? Because those will be very eye-catching, right? Like new grad or about to graduate person, just worked on a side project, or someone that's worked at like a studio before, right? The person that worked at a studio before, immediately going to get, you know, put in the next batch, right? If you think that like, oh, just, you know, education experience, that could probably go further down on the list, and then actual like projects you worked on and what you did on them could probably go higher on that list, right? Because that's going to be more relevant in that case in terms of experience, and then using bullet points, not long paragraphs, like things like that, right?
Yes. Bullet points are key.
Yeah, you got to be real with yourself, right? Like when you lay out your resume, you got to be real with yourself and what you're bringing to that whoever you're sending it to, and you got to prioritize with that in mind to show yourself in the best light. And then from there, kind of tailor it to show, hey, I know what I'm talking about in regards to this role. And then your success rate will go higher.
Yeah. And that's what's your philosophy on cover letters?
I think I've read like one cover letter out of like the like hundreds of candidates I've looked at over the years.
Really?
Maybe
So
like a couple, maybe that's exaggeration, maybe like a couple, but like one, most people don't include them. And then two, a lot of people that do include them are like new grads that were probably like instructed that they should have a cover letter. And they all read like the exact same. Like I
yeah.
don't actually gain any useful information typically from them. I could see how for like possibly for some like very high profile positions, how a cover letter could be useful. But I don't know, typically the higher level of a position that I'm looking at a resume for, you can kind of go off of what they put on the resume, and then you kind of know whether or not you want to talk to them. And you're
Yeah.
going to gain way more from talking to them than you are from reading a cover letter.
Yeah, I think that's
That's,
definitely true. Like
yeah.
the higher the longer you've been in your career, the less necessary that is, but and it's also in line with what you were saying. A lot of them are with, students and younger in their career people. I think that's where it can make the most difference, but man, they can be real bad if they're not written well. Like it can be a deterrent. But a well-written one can do a decent job of kind of giving a frame around who you are and like why you care about the job that maybe your resume doesn't show.
Yeah, and just to keep it a buck 50 full sale, people, you need to work on your cover letters if you're gonna use them, because it's they every single one of them reads the exact same,
Probably have the same template,
so
right? Like every.
exactly. And that's what you like, going back to my previous tips, don't use like templates, don't like do that, because many of your colleagues are probably seeing the same job posting. You're not going to stand out if everyone sends basically the same cover letter to a position.
It's like turning in the same assignment using the same code, right? Like everybody,
Yeah.
pretty easy to tell right off the bat.
Yeah.
That's funny. So,
Not that I've ever like, so to be clear, I've never like eliminated anyone for like a cover letter. Like no one, I've not encountered that kind of a cover letter yet, thankfully. It's just it makes it less likely that I'm gonna look at a cover letter for certain positions. Or if I do, it's gonna be like a quick just okay, yeah, I recognize all this. Moving on.
that makes sense. You're also a pretty to the point person, so I can definitely see that being
Yeah.
a part of
So I
your.
prefer resume. Looking at the
Yeah.
resume, here's the points. Are they selling me on if, they're a good fit for this or not?
Yeah, and that's you mentioned bullet points too. That's my favorite thing about resume. They need to be bullet pointed. Like I'm a quick glance person. So if I can look down and get the gist of everything quickly by reading lines. Like that allows me, you talked about the amount of time. I give 5 minutes. Like you got 5 minutes for me to look at your resume before I look at the rest in the stack, And
Dang,
so
5 minutes.
it's yeah, that's my first kind of what my that's the pace at which I look at them. I will look at them longer if I'm interested in it, things like that. But I tend to just be like, all right, let me look at this and let me look at your portfolio, get a sense of what we're looking at. It's got to be catching though, right? Like it's got to be concise. It has to be like, especially on the portfolio side, I want like little 30-second chunks of the things you've done that I can like quickly absorb and get a sense for like what you're good at.
Yeah, portfolio. If a portfolio is listed like a website, I will look at it for sure, like every time, and I will judge probably more than most people on portfolio. Now, resume, like your pedigree on your resume, like how you present that, will typically be the difference maker. Like if someone's portfolio site looks like it hasn't been maintained in a while, or like it's just kind of bleh, like I'm not like, yep, toss this person out, that person out. That's not how it works. It's you're still compared to like the other, resumes and stuff. It's just like if someone does have a portfolio that's like, wow, this is amazing, even if their resume is like a little bit not as great, like I'll probably, move that person on, right? And yeah, what you said about like resume and portfolio, both bullet points, be to the point. People are gonna look at it very quickly, especially if you have a lot of stuff on your portfolio. At least having like an area that is the, hey, you know, draw your attention here if you don't have a lot of time and you just want to like see stuff real quick.
Yeah.
And then if you really, you know, want to or think it will matter for certain things and you want to have like a blog or a, you know, more detailed like breakdown of stuff, sure, you know, go ahead. I'm probably not going to look at it, but someone out there might, and it might make a difference for them.
It's definitely not going to hurt. So.
Yeah.
All right.
And I'll link in the Discord. This is my portfolio that I have gotten a lot of success with in terms of contacts and things like that.
You okay if I put this in the chat? Yeah,
feel free to share. Another thing, just kind of, I haven't updated in probably 2 years, but I haven't really had anything to like put on it in 2 years. But there's that. Take a look at it. Maybe it inspires you with your portfolio sites.
Nice, man. I wish I had been ready for this. We would have pulled it up and we would have went over it together and I could have shat on it. No, I'm just kidding. No, I'm sure it's great. I haven't seen it yet. I'll take a look at it myself.
Yeah, feel free.
So how long were you at Cubic?
I was at Cubic for, I want to say, I'm going to have to like even just look at my own portfolio to find that. I was at Cubic for, I want to say like 9-ish months. So I went the full length of the contract that they, you know, had me on. And then we got into the whole deal of like, oh, we'll like extend you because we still need you, or we'll like hire you on full. But, you know, it's a big corporation, right? So things move very slowly. It's, you know, not always in the hands of the people that are, you know, wanting to hire you. And so that went on for a couple months, and assuming, and I would advise anyone that's on contracts to always work with this in mind, is that assuming that it would fall through, I was still looking around for like other deals. Even though, you know, I love my managers, they were very kind to me, they really wanted me to like come on full time, it's not always in their power, right?
Yeah.
So I was looking around, asking around, and luckily one of the people that I was close with, I was asking around to, had a spot at on their team at EA Sports working on Madden Mobile. And so I came in, I interviewed for that, and the team liked me, and I was brought on pretty quickly for that.
Yeah, so all that time you spent networking and getting resume help couldn't have helped that at all, right?
Yeah, it's right. Yeah. So it was a, you know, and it was someone that I had talked to many times over my time at Cubic, just for like advice and leads and stuff like that. And it just happened that, hey, that time, just the timing was right. And that's really what did it, right? Is that's something that I keep in mind. It's like a lot of it's like timing, right? That's like one of the luck components of getting a job in the industry, is just you might be a perfect fit for, you know, many different studios, but it's just the timing has to line up with when a headcount is available and who else is applying at that time, and you know, in comparison to you. That's just how it works, and why persistence is key, and why persistence in this case, kind of, you know, persistence and networking paid off.
Yeah, and the timing can be interesting in another way too, where I've networked with people and got to know people that when I didn't have any positions available, or there, you know, there was anything like that, but then later when it became available, I would think of them, right? And then I would reach out to them. And it, so it happens that way too. Don't ever feel like those conversations are like, oh, we don't have anything right now. When people say maybe something will open up, they're being honest. Like, and when it does, they'll try to remember you. But you also got to keep in touch, right? Like, you've got to, you know, keep that relationship going.
Yeah, yeah. And that doesn't mean like constantly hit the person up or whatever. Right. It's just like every once in a while, check in, comment on their LinkedIn thing or, you know, that kind of stuff. Share a post that they put out. Just being, even just present in that notification thing on LinkedIn. That's, you know, that's just another way to kind of just be subtly kind of in people's sphere of knowledge or in the back of their mind, right? In a way that isn't like, hey, what's up, man?
Yeah,
talked to you last week and you didn't get back, like, you know, stuff like that.
You're right, though. But, like, that's a really really good and important way to do it. Is just like just little reminders, you know, or like little touch base. Like, I liked your post. I, you know, I commented on it. Those kind of things. You're right. They, at least from my perspective of when people will do that with me, it keeps them in my memory, you know. And then later when that opportunity comes up, and then they'll be like, hey man, I saw that you guys had this position open, and then I can be like, oh yeah, like, yeah, I remember you. The thing is open now. Let's see if we can make that work. Like, there's a lot of opportunities like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of using the social media algorithm to your advantage, right?
Because
it goes both ways as well, right? You are like their thing or comment on their post or share it or whatever. That keeps your things in their algorithm and their, like, feed. But it also keeps their things in your feed, right? So if they do share, like, hey, we're looking for so-and-so for our project, that'll pop up in your feed, even if you have, like, you know, several hundred connections that the feed is trying to, you know, prioritize. The people that you've actually had an interaction with will get filtered to the top of that, and that's how you can kind of help. It's going to sound, like, cynical, but, like, rank your... connections, I guess, sort of. You know, if companies are interested in, I guess, or teams you're interested in, people you want to work with, or like keep track of and what they're, you know, going on and doing in the industry because you're interested in what they do.
I wonder if there's an opportunity to use AI to help with this now, like a personal assistant that'll let you know when job postings show up at various companies or whenever that person makes something, you should probably go and respond to. there's interesting use here.
Yeah, sort of like a RSS feed, but with more kind of like broad reach, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. I want to think about that now. I was telling Will last week that I've started using AI to help me with my posts, my social posts. So like the one that I put out for this today was like, I'll write up something and I'll throw it into Bard, Google's Bard, and just be like, hey, can you help me make this better? And it comes out sounding better than I did. I'm like, yeah, I'll do that. So, but the weirdest thing, I don't know if you saw, is when it told me it had watched my podcast and it told me about it. It's like, I watched a couple of episodes and here's what I think. I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. That's a little wild.
I wonder if, I mean, it sounds like it has some kind of template that it's probably using
potentially
to, like, review people's stuff when it's, like, asked that kind of a question. Because it sounds like an oddly personal way to put it for an AI, right? But I wonder if it's, like, scraping, like, the closed captions on your YouTube.
Well, I'll say this. I had dug in with it for a while and we were having a conversation about it. And then eventually I asked it, I was like, what do you know about the podcast? And it told me, and it was like pretty, pretty specific. And so I was just like, and it started off saying, I've watched a couple of episodes. So I'm curious what that means. Like, did it literally just sit and absorb the content, or did it do something like you're talking about and kind of scrape for keywords and that kind of stuff? But it also had some like anecdotes that I was like, yeah, that actually kind of describes my stream in a way that isn't written anywhere. So it was a little wild. I'll send it to you later. It was interesting.
Yeah, I'd be interested in that. Wonder if there's just like some obscure WordPress somewhere that reviews podcasts.
Maybe it's possible. it's like looking at the comments and like, what do other people say about this?
Maybe, right? And that could be useful, right? You know, you don't have to look at the comments yourself. The AI will, you know, kind of aggregate it for you and summarize it. Maybe in a less, you know, depending on the podcast, maybe in a less like spiteful internet way, you know.
Right. So, all right. So you now are starting at EA, and so this is your first full-time game job. Tell me what that first month was like. What were your expectations going in? And do you remember kind of like what that was like when you got there?
Yeah. So this is an interesting one because, so part of the cycle of game production, especially on yearly titles, is that a game is about to launch. People see, you know, games about to launch, their work is done, or they feel like their contribution is done. And they're like, all right, now's a good time to like go somewhere else, pursue something else, or they get promoted to another thing or move to another project or whatever. And so then positions open up, right, on to continue on that thing or do the next version of that thing. And so I was one of those people that kind of got hired on to fill in one of those heads that became available because someone went, you know, elsewhere, right, on this project that was just about to launch. And that project was called Madden Overdrive, which was a rebrand of kind of like a reimagining / rebrand of Madden Mobile. And so I came on about a week and a half maybe before it launched, like very, very close to launch. So it was basically like done out the door, just QAing it, testing it, working on, you know, the first bit of post-launch content, that kind of stuff. So I was just kind of absorbing, learning. Everyone was kind of running around, chickens with their heads cut off, trying to fix everything up last minute, all that kind of stuff. And I was just kind of like along for the ride, trying to learn as much as I could, you know, and just kind of shadow my buddy. And so that is all happening. I'm excited. I'm finally working on a project. I'm working on Madden, working on an NFL game. I like played, you know, Madden games growing up as a kid. And this, you know, Madden Overdrive is based on like one of the like Xbox 360 or like PS3 era Maddens, like that's like the kind of like the graphics and physics and stuff that I use. Like that was exciting. Like it's on a phone, that's so cool. Then it launched and it was received very poorly.
Oh,
on launch, like more poorly than you might think, like the typical like yearly sports title is, you right. know. It was above and beyond the poorness scale of being received, and so I.
What were the main complaints? What was it people were you know picking on? If you can or want to say.
Sure. Yeah. So the premise of the game was essentially. Oh, this is all very well documented on the game's forums at this point. I don't know if they still exist, but. The premise of the game was taking Madden Mobile, which is basically Madden Ultimate Team, but on the phone, and making it more accessible, making it more approachable by a broader audience. Madden Ultimate Team is a very complicated game mode. It's very hard to get into. And the goal was to make it more kind of arcadey, more approachable. Anyone could kind of just pick it up and just play it super easily. And so they kind of reduced it fundamentally down to like one core game mode. Called Overdrive, where they basically riffed on the rules of football, shortened the field, made it kind of like a half field kind of, you know, thing. You're only playing on offense because that's like, you know, the most exciting part of football is what the thought was, is you just play offense, you set your defense and kind of just forget it. And the other person plays against your defense and you play against the other person's defense. So it's kind of
like an arena type thing.
Yeah. Like an arena kind of game. Yeah. And people did not like that. They wanted to be able to play full games of football. They wanted to do the, you know, franchise mode. They wanted to do like the drills and like all that kind of stuff. They wanted to play. Some people like really liked playing defense. And there's like other changes to the game that were a part of just kind of like the whole kind of repackaging of the experience that people didn't like. They were very attached to the older experience. And because that old experience, you know, goes away with the new game that comes out, can't access it anymore. People felt very burnt on that. Like they'd had their toy taken away and they can't play with it anymore. And they don't like the new toy, right? And so people really didn't like it. And we spent a lot of the year, that following year, just trying to make right by the community and fix things up and give them all the features and things they wanted. And so that was kind of my introduction to entertainment games, was get in there, game kind of, you know, doesn't go out like, you know, how everyone hoped it would. And then, all right, new guy, help us fix this kind of deal.
Yeah. So were you, how did you feel about that? Were you excited to help turn something around? Were you overwhelmed with the, you know, the responsibility of being a part of something? Like, there's a lot of different ways to feel in this kind of scenario.
Yeah, it was overwhelming at first. Kind of like frustrating at first, because you come in and you kind of like had no, you know, feel like I had nothing to do with this. And yeah, everyone's like yelling at me on the forums or, but then, you know, one of the things that, especially working on like a yearly title, especially like a EA Sports title, is you learn to get that kind of like thick skin. You learn that, you know, it's not personal. People are just frustrated with the experience, and you got to kind of just sift through that and figure out, okay, what is it that they don't like about the game, and what can I do to kind of help make their experience better in the game? And that's kind of the approach I kind of learned to take very quickly. And part of that was from learning from the people that had been there for years and, you know, gone through the ups and downs of titles, right? It's a really good learning experience there in that regard, because you are launching a game every year. And a lot of developers in the industry, they launch a game maybe once every 2 years, maybe once every 4 years, maybe, you know, for some studios, like maybe once every 5-6 years, right?
Yeah.
And so you don't really get a lot of like immediate short-term like feedback on like how you're doing. You don't get a lot of turnaround on, all right, we want to improve XYZ, let's get that out the door, get the feedback on it, improve it. Because that, you know, on a typical cycle could be like each quarter, right? Like a quarterly update, or like a annual expansion or something like that, right? So the turnaround time is typically very, you know, slow. And then the lead is so, the lead up is so long and the runway is so long on each thing, that if you mess up, you might not like get like that next runway, right? Versus with, you know, yearly titles or like yearly sports titles, you know, you get that immediate feedback and then you get to do an update very quickly after that, and they'll push it out. And so yeah, like part of handling that was just like trial by fire and just trial and error, and just very rapidly approaching problems, figuring out what is the, you know, sifting through the feedback, okay, what is the actual like complaint here, what is the actual thing causing this player to not have a good time, or these group of players to not have a good time, and then getting together a plan, putting together you know, the content, the QA plan, getting a QA, getting out the door, very, very fast turnaround on that stuff, on especially mobile games, but also on yearly mobile games. So it was just a drink it through a fire hose of game development. It's like the this one of the sayings there is like, once the train leaves the station, it does not stop. You are on the train, and the only way to get off is you kind of like jump and like roll, right? And that's like your next job that nice. you're doing that for. So yeah.
So was there, while you're spending time improving the next iteration, was there a separate like live ops team that was supporting it live, or is there normally that? Like, how does that normally go?
So on the projects that I was on at EA Sports, I was typically on like the live team there. So that would be, you know, Madden Mobile or later on Ultimate Team on the console games. And the teams that work on those modes are both the live team and the team working on the next iteration. There were no like multiple
I see.
team for that.
Okay.
So there's like a game team that's working on like the bigger kind of features, bigger like improvements, next client, like all that kind of stuff. But the Ultimate Team and the Madden Mobile teams, they're doing all the live updates, all the live content while also working on the next iteration as well. So we'd usually be working, you know, on the game when it launches, and then like 3 to 6 months before the next one comes out, we'd start thinking about, okay, what are we, you know, what are we doing for the next one? What improvements can we make? You know, what do we have the, you know, budget and capacity to like address and make better and all that kind of stuff? What's going to be like our next like big thing? And then some people kind of break off and work like mostly on that, and then a little bit on like, you know, helping the live stuff. But most people kind of stay on live stuff, and then as you get closer, you kind of peel more and more people off to work on the next thing. And then there's usually like a couple people left just making sure that new content's going out. You know, it gets, you know, it gets scaled down, like the players recognize it even. So it's, you know, after like Team of the Year comes out, after like Easter, after that kind of stuff, things start to kind of like slow down a little bit on the live side there. Just because, like, hey, you know, working on the next thing, season's over, you know, that kind of stuff.
There's a question in the chat asking, what would you say was maybe the strangest or biggest WTF moment that you were able to turn into some kind of a win? Anything like that come to mind? I mean, you were dealt a raw hand right off the bat, right? Like,
Yeah.
so so maybe there's something there, but
I think at the time, one of like the things that I'm sure there was like a good reason for it, and so a lot of research and stuff that went into it at the time. But as a new person there, I didn't quite understand why we kind of brought it all down to like one game mode, when part of the draw of like Ultimate Team and like Madden was like, oh, you can like play a full game of football on your, you know, device. You can manage your and play as like any player you want, like your favorite player, all that kind of stuff. And we kind of just made it only offense, only like, you know, half a field, very customized kind of rules and scoring. And so that was kind of like a big, like, oh my God, like, you know, this is cool. Like, this one game mode, like, it's a cool game mode. Like, it's fun to play. But it's not like what everyone wanted. And so we were able to slowly over time, like, reintroduce the other, like, ways of playing. But then that game mode that was the name of the game, Overdrive, that a lot of people liked, and a lot of people new to the series really liked, essentially became like one of our like competitive kind of modes, right? It kind of found its niche in the game, and we kind of built like a whole like competitive kind of game mode like around it, with like its own like rewards and rankings and like all that kind of stuff. And it had like its own kind of dedicated hardcore like fans like within the greater player base of Madden Mobile players, who liked, you know, playing as defense, liked playing league versus league, and liked, you know, the head to head and playing franchise, you know, our franchise style mode and all that kind of stuff. Within that, there was like the Overdrive players, and they just loved Overdrive. And yeah, it was fun to support them and kind of help make like a little competitive environment for them to play the way they wanted to play.
Well, that's cool. That means that not everybody hated the mode too, or that version of the game, I guess, too. So
Yeah, it was a fun game mode. It was actually really fun to play.
that's cool.
It's just not, you know, not what the audience expected
Right.
in the new app.
So then for the next year, where you were focused on making something more like Madden Mobile was, then something more meeting the expectations of the players.
I believe the one after that we just called Madden NFL Mobile. It was kind of like a kind of like a reboot, sort of. The way we kind of approached it was the greatest hits of Madden Mobile was going to be this game, right? Like, we were going to, like, just everything that we thought the players wanted, all the feedback we got, we were going to put all that, as much as we could, just stuff it into this game. And at that point, our content team, our feature team, our, you know, engineers, everyone was, like, very experienced at working on this project and working with these tools and working in that pipeline. And so we were able to accomplish a lot of that stuff because, you know, we didn't really have to worry about training people or people just not being familiar with the capabilities of various things. Like, we were able to do that magical thing that every dev team wants to do, which is everyone's an expert on the tools, and we can just look at them and say, what is the wrinkle we can add to the tool set that will just allow us to, like, greatly expand our, you know, content creation capabilities and, like, leverage it all to its fullest potential. We were able to kind of do that and make a lot of just, I think, awesome, you know, content and features and systems and stuff in that next iteration. And, you know, when it came out, people really liked it, and it was like actually one of my proudest games that I've worked on, because it was, like, really well received, and it was kind of like a recovery from Overdrive. The whole team was, like, awesome to work with. Everyone was super knowledgeable, super experienced, and we were able to make a just great Madden game on the phone on that next iteration.
That's really cool. So that was technically your first, like, real shipped game, right? Like, you were there for the last week of something. So that's yeah. cool. That's that's nice that you feel that positively about something so early in your career.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So how, like, roughly how big was the team, this team of experts that were working on there together?
I think the whole Madden Mobile team, I want to say it was, like, roughly 40 people total. That includes, like, art, production, designer, content designers, feature, you know, designers, PMs, data analysts, engineers, art, you know, QA, everyone together. It was, like, 40 people. The content team, like, the team that I worked directly with, that was, like, you know, a couple artists, a couple QA, couple content people, and it was probably like 12-13 people.
Okay. I mean, I think we would all agree that Madden is the greatest sports game ever. For those that don't know, I had to say that based on something in the chat. But the question would be, which one, right? So how many Maddens have there been? Like 40 at this point?
So many, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Like, my Madden heydays were like 98, like back on the Genesis, those days were real good. Then I really liked around, I think it was what, 2006 or so, when Eddie George was on, no, 2001 or two, when Eddie George was on the cover. And that was, like, when I played the game a lot. But, I have actually a specific question for you about Madden Ultimate Team. So that's once Ultimate Team became available, that's the only way I played the game. Like, I was completely hooked. I loved every aspect of it, except how hard it was to get, like, the topest tier players and cards. But the thing that always perplexed me is I would always buy the deluxe version because it would give free packs for, like, the first 10 weeks. But then after that was done, I would lose interest. Why did it stop at 10 weeks? What's the idea behind that? Do you have any clue?
I think it had... So there's probably a couple reasons, if I had to guess. If I had to kind of think back to just kind of how things were thought of at the time. And part of it probably has to do, probably the thing that most has to do with is relative value of the packs in comparison to when they're coming out. So, and then, but it's not like what you think when I say that, right? Like, probably think like, oh, they want to be like stingy with them. But probably more comes down to needing to continuously update those packs to keep them like relevant. So that's probably part of it. Part of it is like the whole value of it, I'm sure. And then, yeah, I think those are probably the two biggest things. When I was working on it, we actually didn't have that. We had, you just got everything just up front from the deluxe edition. And then the recurring pack that you'd get like the whole year through was based on if you were a what was it even called? Like EA,
the EA
subscription thing. Yeah, like it changed names like
sure
so
did.
Much when I was there. but yeah, it was that was how you'd get like continuous like packs and stuff like that. And the way the whole kind of mode was like designed and how you get things evolved has evolved quite a lot since the inception of it.
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense. I just got distracted by a question or a comment in the chat, which I actually agree with, which is that ping pong game from Rockstar was the best. That game was so good on it was a 360, right? Yeah, I think it was 360. One quick thing about that, though, I love the game. And then I got to the point where I was just getting my ass handed to me and did not realize until someone told me that the spin of the ball was a different color to let you know which way it was going to go. And I was colorblind, so I never saw that. So I didn't know how to prepare for it. I didn't even know what was happening. I was like starting to get frustrated. So
are you a VR enjoyer?
I am. I just got the PSVR 2 actually.
Yeah. One of the things that I picked up on while I was at EA was I became more of like a football fan than I had been for. Like I'd always played like some amount of Madden before that, like Madden 2001 or something, one of those like the blue and Nintendo 64 cartridge.
Mm-hmm.
Played that a lot of that as a kid. But I didn't really like follow NFL really. But then when I got, working on the games, I felt like I needed to follow it and know about all the players and know things. And so one of the ways I did that was started watching the Pat McAfee show. Oh. And on that show, one of the things he had talked about for a while was his addiction to this VR ping pong game.
Really?
So I don't remember the name of it, but it's apparently it's out there and apparently it's very good. So just keep your eye out.
All right. I'm going to make a note of that.
It's a multiplayer as well, I believe.
Really? All right. Do you know if it's on PlayStation or is it just on the Quest? I might have to steal my son's Quest to try it out. Interesting. All right. And they were also talking about Tecmo Bowl in the chat, which I would say Tecmo Super Bowl was, and that probably is actually my favorite sports game of all time. But also Baseball Simulator 1000 on the original Nintendo. Like I played hundreds of hours of that game, like literally hundreds, maybe thousands. It's kind of sad to think about, though. But
backyard baseball was my jam.
Oh yeah, I never played that one. Yeah. I heard a lot of good things though.
It was pretty fun for a kid.
Yeah. Were you? Did you play it on PC? Or was it? I don't remember seeing it. I don't remember what else.
I think I played it on PC. I think it was at like a friend's house. Played it on their PC.
Nice. All right, so
I played a lot of games growing up. It was just over at friends' houses that had the console or had the PC that could run games, like that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's the way mine was too. I generally had them myself, and we would always have people over because I live so far out of town. Like we had to like either have people come over or go to someone's house. Like there wasn't just a neighborhood of kids that I could be around. But that was what we do. Like one would come over and we would just play video games the whole time, and it's some of my fondest memories actually. And now I'm starting to feel old, but we couldn't play online. What was online? There wasn't it didn't even exist yet. So that's me being old. All right, so you're finishing up that first real project for you, and you got like an entire dev cycle, which is great, right?
Yeah.
As you were finishing that up, what was next for you? Did you move on to the next iteration?
Yeah. So I, worked for most of that year on that, and we started working on the next one, Mobile 21. And somewhere along the line of like just kind of getting started on like what that would be, I got pulled onto the Madden Ultimate team.
Okay.
To work on console, because they needed somebody to come in and take over the progression, monetization, and kind of like economy rewards design of that game mode. And what made sense at the time was just get the person that does it for Madden Mobile to come do it, because at that point I was one of the people that on Madden Mobile that was kind of like the point person for figuring out like rewards and progression and using spreadsheets and all that kind of stuff. So it was kind of like, all right, come help us do that on Madden Ultimate Team on console. So I swapped onto that team and helped launch Madden Ultimate, kind of helped finish up the 20 season of Madden Ultimate Team, while also kind of helping the Madden Mobile team where they kind of needed the handoffs. And then helped launch Madden 21.
Nice. And so I assume that being on the main game is kind of the more prestigious role. Was it kind of viewed that way?
I'd say overall, like for most people, just in general, it could probably be viewed that way just because it's the more high profile project, right? It's like the one people think about when they think of Madden, right? They think of the one that's all in your Xbox or your PlayStation. So there's that. It's got like a lot more eyes on it. Mm. It's got a lot more investment, makes a lot more money. And so it's kind of like a lot more responsibility, a lot more checks and balances on everything you do. Versus on mobile, it almost felt kind of like we were this little, like, almost like indie team within this giant organization that was kind of just doing our thing, just kind of going rogue when we needed to. And so I kind of missed that going to the more prestigious project, I guess you could say. But there were, benefits as well, like the amount of people seeing the things that I was putting out there design wise was much larger, right? So the amount of feedback I was getting was much more thorough, I guess you could say. And it was less complex in some ways as well. So I was able to kind of focus in on a specialization a little bit more at that point in my career versus Madden Mobile, where everyone still kind of needed to be a jack of all trades, sort of, because, we were making the whole game, basically, not just one game mode on the game.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. Okay. Yeah. So it's almost like an indie game setup versus AAA setup, right? Where, or at least the way we traditionally talk about those, where the smaller team, more hats you've got to wear, more roles you've got to fill. When you moved on to the bigger team, how like focused did your work get? What was it like there?
It got very focused in comparison, right? So on Madden Mobile, I would make live events. I would hook up the art that the artists are providing. I would work with the artists on what art needs to be made. I would work with QA to like make test plans and make, that kind of stuff, help test things. I would make players cards, make like balance the stats on players and hook all the stuff up for them. I'd do stuff with the store, like design store packs, fill out the odds, and like run like the simulations for that kind of stuff. Would to help set up like the messaging for events, like the in-game, like things that pop up and kind of tell you what's going on in the game.
Wow.
Design events, like we have like a holiday event coming up. We need to design like the events and the structure and what rewards you get and like all the conversion sets for like trading currencies into cards and like all that kind of stuff. So you kind of just did it all, right? And then we kind of just rotated around to wherever things were needed. Some people specialized to like an extent on Madible. Like we had a guy that was like just really good at making players, and so he would mainly focus on making like players and making like the really sought after players, so we could always make sure like that, yep, people will definitely want, you know, that player and like things like that. But then there was a group of us that were kind of just like the guns for hire of the content team, of just going around just doing all the things, making sure everything was kept moving. But I sort of like kind of started to soft specialize in that group to, you know, could do all the things as everyone else could, but I would be kind of like the guy for, you know, the economy stuff, like the spreadsheet stuff, the rewards, the progression, that kind of stuff. So other people could like do it enough to like help themselves, but on like bigger things or higher priority things, you know, I would be put on those things, or I would help, you know, a PM or someone else with it. And so then I went on to console on Madden Ultimate Team. That was kind of the niche I kind of like went into. And so it kind of became, that's all I did, was designers would work on their event structures and what like the drills were, or like what the scenarios and all that kind of stuff were. The player guys would just work on the players all day. We have like dedicated people just for like messaging and like stuff like that. And then all I did was economy, progression, monetization, like that kind of stuff. That was just kind of the wheelhouse I was in. And anyone that needed anything to do with that, I would help them. And, you know, there was like a phase of creating an event. And then I had my own kind of little phase in there, right? Or it's like the, all right, fill in the rewards and like numbers and stuff phase. And versus on mobile, where it was like my phase was, you know, the whole thing, like some role in like the whole thing.
And so did you get the monetization work because of an enjoyment or skill in it? Or did you find that skill and enjoyment after you started doing it?
So the monetization stuff, kind of view it as more just like a necessity thing. I don't like necessarily like enjoy, you know, that, but it's something that, you know, has to be done on a free-to-play game or like a live service game. And I was good at balancing it in a way that, you know, people could interact with it and all that kind of stuff within the context of Madden, and could follow like the formula and all that kind of stuff. And the thing that I really enjoyed and that I love to talk about is the like progression side of it, the reward side of it, like that kind of stuff is what really drew me to that kind of work. And then the monetization stuff was just like a, you know, someone has to do it on the project, and a lot of times it just makes the most sense that the person that's doing all the other spreadsheet stuff is also doing that, or the person that, or like the PMs do it, or, you know, there's a dedicated person that does it sometimes, like that kind of stuff. Yeah, in the case of Madden, there's the person that did progression, economy, rewards, all that kind of stuff, also did monetization stuff. And that's of course not just like a one person job on like a big high profile project, right? Like I was, you know, implementing the like packs and like all that kind of stuff. But in an organization like that, there's like a whole, you know, team that specializes in making sure that all the metrics are right, are doing all like the studies and the all that kind of stuff to keep everything moving.
Okay. That makes sense. So at what point did you decide that it was time to move on?
It's probably after Madden 21. So probably like halfway through, maybe like a, yeah, about probably halfway through Madden 21. It wasn't anything like bad. Like I wasn't like angry or like fed up or anything. It was just, I was ready to kind of move on and see a new game, right? Because yeah. after working on the same game for many years, same franchise for many years, and then knowing that, you know, the next ones are going to be the exact same, right?
Solving the same problems over and over, right?
Yeah. Yeah, you kind of want to just kind of see what else is out there. And I always kind of had like a greater ambition of like doing something brand new. And that opportunity came along. And I'd always been kind of just passively kind of like, because I always knew that eventually I was going to move on from EA Sports. It was just kind of a matter of when and, you know, when I would, at what point would I have honed my skills enough to be, you know, useful where I want to be. And one of the places that I had applied to early on was a systems design position on Elder Scrolls Online at ZeniMax Online Studios. And I'd gone through the whole, you know, interview process for that, and it didn't work out at the end. I got to like the final round, and it was just like, you know, someone else won the contest. And like a year later, about, you know, halfway through Madden 21, I got contacted by a recruiter at ZOS, and they asked me to come to a like a online kind of like career fair thing. So it was kind of like what you said earlier of like you reach out to somebody, you talk to them, or you interview with them or something like that, you leave a good impression, you stay present in the kind of space, and then maybe you'll get contacted again, right? And yeah. that's kind of what happened. I didn't like apply again at ZOS or anything like that. They, a year later, you know, reached back out to me and said, hey, show up at this location at this time and for the, you know, something, right? And I show up not really knowing what to expect. They I'm in this like lobby with like tons of other people. They're all kind of chatting, and you know, while I'm in this lobby, I'm also like promoted into work, like working on Madden stuff. So I'm just kind of like, all right, I, you know, whatever, this like online career fair, it seems like a lot of like students and like hobbyists and stuff. It's like, eh, I don't really care about this. And I'm like, you know, if someone wants to talk to me, like I'll talk to them and we'll do the whole thing. But I was really just focused on like doing my work and all that kind of stuff. And then I get a mess, and I go into like one of the, it has all these like subrooms, right? Go into one of these subrooms and it's like line up to talk to whatever designer guy or, you know, programmer guy or whatever, right? And like do your pitch for why you should, you know, get a spot there. And I go into the designer room and there's like 30 people in line to like talk. So I'm like, all right, I'll just hang out, but I'm not gonna like expect anything. And then I got a message kind of, you know, saying, you know, the, you know, a creative director wants to like talk to you, like accept message or whatever. And I'm like, sure. Okay, all right. Yeah. So I'm in the right spot then. And I ended up talking with Ben Jones, creative director of the project I'm on. And he told me about it, which I can't really say anything about it. It's still under wraps. But it was very exciting. And I was like, this is exactly what I'm looking for. It's something brand new, never been seen before. And it sounds like it's the role for me. And everything that I'd wanted. And so I said, yeah, let's do it. And then I went through the, you know, process and all that kind of stuff beyond that, and ended up at ZeniMax. And so I wrapped up sort of like some of the preliminary work I was doing on Madden 22 at the time and handed it off to the person that was going to be succeeding me, and then moved on to ZeniMax Online Studios, where I am now.
And you got away from the Florida allergens, so good for you.
I did.
And then found new ones.
Yeah, found the Maryland allergens.
Nice. So did that, one piece I'm curious about connecting here is the, Was it the same like recruiter that invited you to this thing? And then how did the creative director know to reach out to you? Do you know like who, like kind of who made those connections?
I'm not sure. Like what I'm guessing is that they just kind of had a stack of, you know, resumes that they'd seen or like considered for like other things, right?
Okay.
And they were like, all right, let's just bring all these people together, and then we got all these positions to fill. Let's just talk to all these people that we've already kind of vetted.
Okay.
Is how I'd assume it went. Like, I don't know for sure if like that's how exactly it works, but that would, you know, make sense to me.
Yeah.
And how they would know about me and know to contact me. And then as far as what possessed Ben to message me, I don't know. I imagine he was just looking at a list, right, and just kind of picked someone.
Well, I mean, like, I know there's times when I've worked at places where when we sometimes have two or three candidates we'd love to hire for that one position, and then we all be like, seriously, like, let's keep them at the top of the list, because the next time something opens up, we want to make sure that we speak with them about it. So it's possible you were in that short stack of, you know, people they'd already vetted, and, you know, you were like literally this close to getting that other job before. Like, that's important information, right? Like, I would think that would get spread out to someone, or at least should, right?
Yeah, I'd imagine. Yeah.
So did you know anybody like at ZeniMax when you took this role, or did you go to a studio and you were fresh meat? Like,
I'd known, I think, just one person. I think I just knew Juan Sanchez.
Oh yeah.
Was the only person I knew that was at ZOS. But other than that, I don't think I really knew anybody outside of the people that I'd, like, you know, done an interview with the year prior.
All right.
So it was kind of just all new to me.
That's exciting. Done that a few times. Real quick in the chat, someone asked, did you get to go to Disney World while you were at Electronic Arts? I have a feeling there's a story here.
There is, yeah. So for one of the years... So usually, you know, Florida, there's hurricanes that happen.
Sure are.
And most places in Florida, when the hurricane like passes over them, lose power, get flooded, like all that kind of stuff, right? But certain things need to keep going, right? And one of those things is the live service of Madden. And certain places in Florida typically do not lose power, no matter what happens, right? And so I was kind of a designated survivor almost. That was kind of sent, was put up in a hotel in Disney with a laptop.
I love it.
And I kind of just kept things running. While the hurricane came through.
That is awesome. And you're right. Like, Disney does not lose power, man. Like, it takes like a direct hit for that place to go down. So that's impressive.
I think it was hitting during like one of our big events too. So it was like important. It was more important than usual that things run smoothly. So I ended up just typing away on my little laptop in a dark hotel room in Disney while the hurricane kind of came through.
I love it. That's a great story though. Like, that's that's interesting thinking, and that it probably served. They probably had a point where they had to find power, and that was the place they found it, or something along those lines in the past. that's good times. I like that. So
yeah, it was interesting. The internet was not very good though. The internet was very bad, so it was very spotty work in and out. We didn't, you know, so there were some times where we didn't know if the content was gonna make it live or not. But we ended up making it work.
That's funny. So we've only got about 10 minutes left. Is there anything that's on your mind or that you wanted to make sure we chatted about, or anything you want to tell us that's going on?
Well, I'm excited about the Brown season coming up. I'm sure you are as
Yes.
well.
Somebody in chat
So
wanted
it's
me to
been
say
a
that the
pretty good.
Bengals are the best team in Ohio, and I was like, I'm not saying that. That is not within reason. So
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's a little up in the air right now because the Browns have had a really good offseason this year.
yeah.
So
I
we'll see
dude,
what happens.
I gotta admit, I'm very optimistic. I still struggle a little bit with having Deshaun Watson as the quarterback, just because of the outside of football stuff. But overall, I'm really excited for the way the team is shaping up, and I think it's going to be a surprising year. But I feel that way every year, and I'm usually wrong. So what do I know?
Yeah, you kind of just roll the bunches with the Browns. It's like, yeah, we had a great offseason, but who knows what happens between now and fall.
It's true. The wild thing is like August 3rd is the first preseason game, and that will be here before you know it, which is crazy.
That's right.
But yeah, man. So, I mean, if there's nothing else that you want to chat about, we can wrap up a few minutes early. But I do have one other question.
Sure,
If people want to reach out to you and they have questions about, what you can tell them, or they just want to reach out for some advice, are you cool with that? And in what way would you like for them to reach out to you?
I think well, LinkedIn's really the only way to contact me at the moment if you don't, know me. So it's that's probably the main way. So you just search my name on LinkedIn, you'll find me. And that's, yep, that's how you get in touch if you want to get in touch about anything.
Awesome.
And then we're hiring as well for both ESO as well as our new project that we're working on. So if you're interested in that or want to check out the roles, you jump on over to ZeniMax Online Studios website and check out the careers page.
Yeah, and there's this guy that works there that could probably take a look at your resume, and your own advice is going to get turned against you.
Oh no.
Oh boy. All right, bud. I'm gonna get ready to jump off here, say my goodbyes, and once you do announce your game and are able to talk about it a little bit more, we should have you come back on and tell us kind of what you're doing.
Yeah, of course.
Cool, man. I appreciate you, and I will talk to you soon. Have a good one, buddy.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Later. Hey, thanks for watching. Don't forget to subscribe and turn on notifications below so you'll know when new episodes are ready. If you're interested in the audio version of the podcast, I've got links for that in the show notes for you. And if you want to join us live and get your own questions answered, we're at twitch.tv/JamesonDorrell every Wednesday night at 7 p.m. Eastern. Have a good week, and we'll see you soon.
Start this ease conversation, and I remember, and I this has defined my career to date. So if you ever if you chat with him, you say to him, this is it. This has defined my career. Is he was pouring tea or coffee at the time, and I was like, hey, how do I get to where you're getting to? Right? I'm early, you've already done a lot of stuff. And he's like, listen, you need to get experience. Get experience in any way, shape, or form that you can do. Right? Something that you can accomplish, that you can get over the edge, you can finish, do that. And so I've taken that to heart for the last 13 years. I don't care if it was for the medical industry, I don't care if it was for the